All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your hosts for today's program, Dale Thronberry and Bob Gould.
Ah, yes, welcome once again to Veterans Radio. This is Bob Gould with my partner, Dale. Yeah, Dale, you got first billing, and you know what?
Well, I've been here longer than you have.
I guess so. I'm not sure.
More often lately. But we're welcome. We're glad to have you back, Bob, and it's really good
Thank
to have you.
You
in the hosting place over there, and I just get to sit back and ask questions. I like that.
Well, today we
Speaking of,
Dr. Rebecca Grant, one of our most popular guests. She's standing by and definitely wants to give us a whole bunch of information on Russia, China, North Korea, and of course, what are we talking about right now, Dale? You know, this is the 100th anniversary of the Air Force, and also the RAF is claiming 100.
All right.
And I think the French, and I think the Germans.
Everybody's claiming it. Don't forget, though, we got the end of World War One. Also coming up. So,
they're all claiming to be the first. We got to get
there.
Well,
there were only four planes in the air, you know, at that time, so we got to remember, you know, who was first.
We will get that straight when Dr. Grant comes on. Dale, we have somebody that's going to be a contributor. Would you like to introduce the captain?
Well, we have a couple of guests in the studio right now, and I'm going to welcome a new interest for Veterans Radio, and this is Dan Griffin, and Dan and his partner Gene Simon, I believe it is, have founded an organization called Griffin Secure Transport. And Dan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. And thank you to the listeners. So, yeah, like you said, Gene and I founded Griffin Secure Transport. Ultimately, it's a transportation company for medical cannabis. And the bottom line is we're hiring, and we have a heavy emphasis on hiring veterans. A veteran myself noticed a large overlap, basically eclipse in the veteran skill set between what this booming industry is calling for and what we have to offer. So put those two things together, and the bottom line is, if there's anybody out there who's listening that finds this interesting, please contact us. You can contact us at griffinsecuretransport.com. You can go there for our phone number and email as well.
Yep.
And looking forward to hearing from you.
Well, we're going to talk more about this business later on, but we just wanted to make sure that Dan got introduced to you out there, because we were just talking earlier on. He's got a lot of story ideas, and so we're excited to do this. Plus, he's less than half our age, so we know that he can tell us what's going on currently, and I think that's going to be very helpful for all of us.
And don't forget, folks, we always tell you folks to have something standing by so you can write this stuff down. We always give you good information. You got to be able to write it down. So we will give you the Griffin Transport Services website. All the information is there, okay? Got it? And they are hiring veterans. Ooh, boy, how can we do that? Mm.
Great job.
Yes.
Speaking of hiring, we got a couple of events that are coming up, Bob.
What do you got?
I got a hiring event for veterans and their families. It's coming up. It's a Hire Michigan Veterans. It's on November 13th, 2018 at Washtenaw Community College. And it runs from, runs from 9 till 11:30 on November 13th. And they're hiring like crazy. I hope all these different people, and I just gave this to Dan earlier, so hopefully Griffin Secure Transport is going to be a participating employer there as well. But things like Applebee's, Rocket Mortgage, Blue Cross Blue Shield, the VA, St. Joe's, University of Michigan, Roush Motors, which we had a Roush on last week on Veterans Radio, Bush's Market, Zingerman's. You want to find a job, we're going to help you find that job. So show up at Washtenaw Community College November 13th, 2018, around 9 o'clock. Dress to get a job before you leave.
Absolutely. And maybe have a few things about yourself.
Have your resumes and everything else with you.
Resumes and whatever, letters. And folks, hiring the vet is really cool because they show up. They do their job. They do what they are told. Got
they,
it?
They follow instructions.
They follow instructions.
Well.
They follow orders. How can I get a hold of them? Well, you're going to want to go to, Dan, give us that website again.
GriffinSecureTransport.com.
You got that? GriffinSecureTransport.com. All right, stuff going on. The GeroFit program is for older veterans at the Ann Arbor VA. And what I got here is 734-998-7424. This is really cool. Getting veterans now for cardiovascular, improving balance, become more active, tailored to your goals and abilities. That's here in Ann Arbor, 734-998-7424. I'm going to do it. Dan, you got something?
Yes, sir. So we got an update on the weekly Detroit Ruck. Every Sunday, Team Red, White, and Blue and 22 Unit None, changing the weekly Ruck location and starting time. It's going to be 0900 each Sunday, start and finish at the Collin Plaza, 1340 Atwater Street, Detroit. This is a ruck on the Detroit Riverfront, Plaza, and Carousel. There's free parking lot near the plaza, and ruck 4 to 6 miles, multiple routes to choose from at the Collin Plaza, and bring any weight or none. For more information, email Mike at Team Red, White, and Blue.
Wow, the ruck. And I'll bet you've done a few rucks, right, Maureen?
Yes, sir.
Well, exactly.
And, it's about 15 pounds, 10 pounds. No, folks, this is really something. Yeah. How far do you run? Or can you run? Let's say, how far do you generally do they run on these things?
The distances change.
Okay.
Anywhere from 4 to 6 miles. And, you know, if you want to stuff the ruck with pillows. Pillows might be 3 to 4
feathers.
Pounds. Right.
Well, what weighs more, 10 pounds of feathers or 10 pounds of lead?
Ba-dum-bum-bum.
That's right. Ooh, that was a trick. All right, Dale, what do you got?
Oh, I was just going to ask Dan what a ruck is.
So a ruck traditionally is a medium weight, more of a run. So you got the Force March, which is a heavy packs.
Okay, so it's a backpack that you're wearing a backpack while you do this.
Generally, the pack size is about a three-day pack, so it's a little bit smaller than the full pack. Allows you to run, be a little bit more mobile. But some folks run with them, some folks walk with them. You know, all depends on capability and what you're comfortable with.
I think it's really it's very interesting because there's a Vietnam veteran that I know who ran in it, I think he said 2 weeks ago, and he said it almost killed him. But he's been practicing. He had been practicing with a ruck at 60 pounds is what he's wearing. And he said he ran 6 miles. And
with 60 pounds. Whoa.
Yeah, and he's still alive. I don't know how far I would be able to get. I can't imagine getting more.
Well, if you had a cab, maybe.
Yeah, maybe Uber. But I think it's one of the things that we're trying to do here at Veterans Radio, why we're talking to Dan and Gene, is that we're trying to talk to these younger veterans whose experiences are different than ours. And, you know, they're still trying to find work and still trying to find jobs and trying to figure out where they want to go with their lives. And so the idea here at Veterans Radio is that we're going to bring these younger veterans on and to find out where the jobs are, where the training might be. And maybe, you know, they're entrepreneurial. They have ideas. They want to be successful just like everybody else does. And this is an opportunity for all of you younger veterans out there and some middle-aged veterans that are looking for jobs. This type of job is perfect for them.
Oh, they're perfect.
I think it's a great
really
concept.
Cool,
we're going to talk about it more.
I think that Dan is looking and Gene are looking to, and I don't know if this can be possible, all right, but they want to have as much as they can an all military outfit. Got it, folks? Is that cool? Way cool. I can see a whole bunch of marketing ideas. Dale, what else you got coming up?
Oh, let's see. I got free classes for veterans coming up here at Wayne State University. This is the Veterans Upward Bound programs at Wayne State's offering free college preparatory classes. That's easy for you to say. Classes include math, grammar, foreign language, computer skills. They offer transportation to and from class. This is another great idea. I tell you, folks, people out there want to help you. If you're a veteran and you're lost, there are organizations that are out there to help you. So you got to give them a call, though. You got to call 313-577-9710. 313-577-9710. Probably, I'm guessing that if you called Wayne State University and asked for their Veterans Upward Bound program, that they'd be able to help you out. Free classes. Come on, guys.
Can you believe that?
Men and women.
And parking. Okay, Gene, you got something.
Hey, folks, wanted to let you know about a fun happening on Saturday, October 27th. The Yankee Air Museum is hosting a free Halloween spooktacular from 10 to 3. Come on out for some spooky games, a costume parade, and a wax museum. Again, this is free for all, located at the Willow Run Airport in Belleville. Come on out. Love to see you.
Yeah.
There you go. I see two voices are born. Radio-based voices are born here today.
Okay, folks. Well, I think that's about it. There was one. Yeah, they're going to be moving this thing. Okay, let's go to break, and then we're going to come right back with Dr. Rebecca Grant. Don't you go away. Yes, a U.S. Air Force aim high. We're talking about the United States Air Force 100th anniversary. That's right, 100 years of air flight. I was there, no, 100 years ago, I was out at Kitty Hawk, and I saw Kill Devil Hill and the spot where it all happened. It was really very exciting. And now to tell us all about that is Dr. Rebecca Grant, who is director of the Billy Mitchell Institute for Air Power, and she's also part of the Air Force Association, contributing editor for the Air Force Magazine. You want to get a hold of the Air Force Magazine. Okay, that'd be a nice Christmas present for everybody. Okay, yeah, give them a prescription, subscription. I got to get that right. It's been a while, Dale.
I know. It's like learning English all over again.
Dr. Grant is a senior fellow at the Lexington Institute. She earned her PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics. Oh, wow. And has worked for the RAND Corporation and the United States Air Force. She's also founded IRIS, Independent Research Institute. Yes, a public policy research organization. Dr. Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Bob, Dale, it's nice to be back with you again.
It's nice to talk to you again, too, Dr. Grant.
Okay, well, here we go. Infantry needs soldiers to close quarters. We're going back now to World War I. So before, you had to get real close to everybody, but then somebody looked up and said, hey, we've got a whole new spot now, a whole new place that's wide open. And the spirit of the sky, I think, was there in the gentlemen and some of the women that were visionary, and they saw this, and they had grit. And grit means determination to make this happen. Some of them, when they started flying, were just boys. And there it was. The whole sky was now their easel. It was a chance for them to write whatever history they wanted to write. Dr. Grant, it's 1917. Take us back to that.
And it happened so fast. You talked about the Wright brothers with their successful test in 1903. They went back to Ohio and built even better versions of their flyers, but it wasn't until 1908 that the U.S. Army held a contest for someone to build a flying machine. Well, Orville and Wilbur were the only ones who showed up with a flyable airplane. And then 10 years later, we see masses and masses of airplanes on the Western Front. And Dale, I'm going to have to scold you, because you said there were just a few airplanes in the sky in World War I. But the battle I want to talk to you about here is called the Battle of San Miguel. And it was important. It happened in the fall of 1918, so 100 years ago. General John Pershing, the U.S. Army, was in command. And this battle was important because it was the first time that the U.S. Army had done an offensive on their own. Prior to that, there had been a lot of hard fighting, but always supporting the French in their sector of the line. This was a very big deal, and there was a man named Colonel Billy Mitchell. He was a great Army officer. He'd gotten into the flying game, and he decided that they needed to really plan a big supporting air attack. And Dale, the number of planes he wanted 1,500 planes. Whoa. For this attack.
1,500. Wow. that to me is a huge number of airplanes, especially when they're all in the same sky. That's dangerous to me.
You know, and the thing is, it was only 15 years since the first flight, which was 1903. That's just amazing. Okay, so now they're thinking about we've got this aerospace. We got this area that we're going to. What happened after that? Okay, here they are. They're assisting France, tell us about that battle.
So Mitchell comes up with this plan, and he talks Pershing into approving it. And they've got a lot of tasks. They use these planes for artillery spotting. They also use them to keep air superiority over the line so that the Germans can't move their fighters in. And they even have bombing aircraft at this point that go back and bomb the rail yards. But Mitchell was a little overambitious, because he only had about 400 American planes available. So what he did was he borrowed planes from France and Britain, whole units, to assemble for this offensive under his command. And that's what's so unique. This is the first time we see that great Allied air offensive. That pattern repeats many times in World War II, in Desert Storm, even back in April of this year, of 2018, when we see France and Britain and the U.S. combine for a strike on the Syrian chemical facilities. So Mitchell's really the first one who combines this many aircraft to support a ground attack. And it's a big success. Participating in the attack is a lieutenant named Eddie Rickenbacker, who comes out of that war as America's ace of aces. He flies three sorties that day, mostly strafing German troops that are trying to retreat as the Americans move forward. But it was a major, major offensive. And so the Air Force now celebrates this as the marker of the 100th anniversary of air power. There was a cake at the Pentagon. The Secretary of the Air Force, Heather Wilson, marked this occasion back in September. So we really are at that 100-year point of the dawn of air power in real combined arms operations, supporting the Army and doing important work of its own behind enemy lines.
Dale, you had something. You were going to tell me about Rickenbacker, Eddie Rickenbacker.
He was one of the first American aces for shooting down the German planes. I'd like to kind of backtrack a little bit into the aviation history, if we can, when we were talking about coming up with 1,500 airplanes, probably all pretty much all biplanes. How did the technology, if you would care to go into this, is the technology from 1903 evolve so quickly up until, you know, World War I, well, now we've got the German aircraft and the American and the French and the English.
And the aircraft that Americans flew in World War I were almost all French airplanes. So the Wright brothers, complete unique achievement both in the engine and the control of their flying machine. But within a couple years, the lead passes to France and Germany and to Britain, and the technology moves very, very quickly. The big changes, improvement in engine power and in control surfaces. And then one of the most important things for the armies is you're in an airplane, you're up. You can see. You can take pictures. So that becomes important, too. Machine guns are mounted, and they are positioned to fire through the propeller. And so then we have bombs, and we see as much as 500-pound bombs being used in World War I, an incredible acceleration in technology.
I'd like to think that some of that, or a good portion of the advance of aviation, was because of the tank. They had to have something else to counter the tank. You want to comment on that, Dr. Grant?
Yeah, tanks were coming along at that same period in time, and you know they suffered some of the same technology problems of how do you have them be reliable and how do they have the kind of range. Both biplanes and the World War I tanks were limited in their range versus what we see in World War II when you think of Patton moving so quickly across Europe. But it was all about trying to get over and above those terrible trench lines that now just bisected Europe. And they had found, you know, not long after the 1914 offensives, that there was no moving beyond this massed fire with the repeating machine guns and the artillery that was brought in. So tanks and airplanes were both designed to bring back a form of maneuver warfare where you could maneuver your force around and finally achieve victory.
You know, we were talking about the pilots, and they were swashbuckling, and they had the white scarves and the leather jackets.
They set the mold.
I know, but the one thing they didn't have, at least you can get up, but how are you going to get down if you get shot out? Talk about that, Dr. Grant. What did they do, and when did they realize they had to have a parachute?
Right. Parachutes were basically unknown in this World War I time frame. That was a huge change, and of course many, many losses. You know, you really see this fascination with the pilots who set the mold in some of the early motion pictures. Mm-hmm. The first movie to ever win an Oscar was about World War I air battles, called Wings, right? Mm-hmm. And there's an incredible fascination between Hollywood and the development of the biplane air power. But right after World War One, every side learned that they needed new technology. Parachutes, which had been tested and experimented with, they really went into further development. The aircraft engines became more powerful. They built bigger and better bombs as well and tried to push some of this in. But, of course, you know, in the 1920s, there wasn't as much interest. Then the Depression came along. And so it really took until into the 1930s to see another generation of combat aircraft emerge, monoplanes with metal fuselages, and where everybody had a parachute.
I was going to mention the wings. I think that that's a great opportunity for our audience if they ever want to see what World War II, air battles, dogfights as they call them, would look like. And with these little biplanes zipping around all over the place, they were extremely maneuverable.
They were. And Wings also has a somber view of combat as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not all just the dogfighting in this. It's a good, it's a nice sort of discussion on what that war was like, and it gets some of the somber character of it, as along with the amazing swashbuckling dogfights that were so central to that. Of course, the tactics evolved very quickly in World War One, and the pilots soon figured out that it worked well if you were in groups, and you could spot your enemy a little bit better and work in a team to bring down enemy aircraft, and that's something that our pilots still do today.
It is. The idea of, attacking from the sun instead of going, into the sun, and all those different techniques that fighter pilots, as you mentioned, continue to use today. I've been reading a book about Jimmy Stewart. And he was for our audience, Jimmy Stewart, the actor, was a pilot during World War II, but he loved flying starting in the 30s. And the idea of aviation just catching on, as it was so exciting to the population, I think, during the 1930s.
I'm so glad you mentioned Jimmy Stewart, because he was a remarkable airman. He had an Oscar in hand when he went down to the recruiting station and signed on, and it took him a long time to get a combat assignment. When he did, he flew B-24s. Mm-hmm. And this was not publicity stuff. He flew real missions. He flew over Berlin and some of the most heavily defended targets. The most interesting thing to me is he was given command of a part of a squadron that had lost a lot of aircraft in World War II, mm-hmm. and given the task of rejuvenating the morale. So he was a true operations officer. He later worked on the planning staff at 8th Air Force. This was a real bomber pilot who set aside all of Hollywood and came out with a tremendous, tremendous service record. And he actually stayed in the Air Force Reserves, eventually retiring at the rank of Brigadier General.
That's correct. I bet you read the same book.
folks, I want to mention here right now that Dale, my partner in our Veterans Radio, was a pilot. Mm-hmm. So he can walk the talk, folks. Got it?
Well, not on an airplane. I never got to go upside down, thankfully.
But you also talked about what, flying 800 miles an hour?
I joke with jet pilots because they can fly 800 miles an hour, and I always ask them how fast can they go backwards. And so I've kind of got them on that one at least. So
we've got 2 minutes before we go on the break. And by the way, can we have the bump music? All right, got it. I gave it to my man Rich. He's right getting ready. And let's see, Dan, you got something? Quick question? Gene?
No, I think we've overwhelmed them.
Yes.
And when you have a guest like Dr. Rebecca Grant who knows the Air Force inside and out, it's kind of tough to stump her with a question, and we're not
– I know.
But even ask her a question.
I know.
But I do have one quick one if you only have a minute or so to go, is if you could talk about real quickly the transition from regular – I guess I can't call them regular airplanes, but what am I thinking of? Before jets, going from into jet engines. When was the jet engine or jet planes introduced to the world?
Boy, that was slow. The Germans did it first. They had the ME-262 actually flying combat. It was short range and unreliable, but man, was it scary. And a lot of the big bomber raids we did in World War II were to knock out German jet fighter production.
Mm-hmm.
We did not really have an operational jet until after World War II. So we never deployed them. There were some in test, But it was really with Korea that we see the jet age begin.
Okay. All right.
I think that this is it. Ah, there it is. The orchestra's back up. I'm glad the guys are getting ready and they're playing. So we'll be right back with Dr. Rebecca Grant. We're going to talk about Russia, China, North Korea. Oh, boy. Bye. Ah, yes, that's the Andrews Sisters, Bugle, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. I'll bet you a lot of Air Force guys were listening to that day and night, even before they went on those big missions. Right now, we get back with Dr. Rebecca Grant. We're talking all about what's going on in the world, 100th anniversary of the Air Force, flying, etc., etc. I got something right now. It's an update on North Korea, de-nuking. What the heck? Is that still on track? Tell us about that, Dr. Grant.
Yes, North Korea denuking is still on track. We'd all like to see it moving faster. But this is the agreement that President Trump and Chairman Kim reached in Singapore back in June. Kim agreed to do some things. We weren't told what all those things were, but they included closing down a nuclear test site that he probably didn't need anyway, and destroying some missile test equipment. So Secretary Pompeo has been over again recently, had a fairly successful trip there, and we're just on a path to seeing if North Korea really will go for full and fully verified and final denuclearization. Where we are now is kind of waiting to see. Kim agreed to let international inspectors back into North Korea. The last team was in there in April of 2009. So he's agreed in principle to do it, but we're waiting to hear more details.
Okay. On a basis of color, is that red hot, so-so, or very cool blue?
I'd say we're pink for the moment. You know, definitely not red hot, but I think it's important to remember here that denuclearization is a really drawn-out process. When Ukraine became independent after the Soviet Union broke up, it took them 4 years to fully denuclearize, and that was a democracy that had a lot of help from the U.S. and from the Russian government at that time. So I think the fact that we are less than a year into the North Korean denuclearization means we're still on track. A lot, really everything depends on whether Kim Jong-un is going to trade nuclear material for sanctions relief and economic development. There are strong signs he's willing to do this, but this is a Stalinist dictator, and it is going to take him some time. It all depends on if he wants to continue establishing this improved relationship with South Korea and President Moon there. So it's up to the political will of Kim Jong-un, a little scary, but it is on track. I'd like it to see it moving faster, but I have to say it's on track.
Okay, I don't want to counter this, but I did pick up something in doing a little research coming from Seoul, South Korea. That's their first public comment that they're talking about, and they say that the North Koreans, I'm reading here, have up to 60 nuclear weapons. If that's true, then what do we do about that? Are they going to be destroyed, or is that just a lot of whatever?
Right. And, you know, when President Trump met with Kim Jong-un in Singapore, he came out of that meeting and said, well, they had more than we thought. But that actually is about what analysts agree, that they have possibly that many weapons. It isn't necessarily a big surprise. We hadn't seen it reported, but I think the analysis suggested that given the rate of processing in their reactors, they could have about that many. I suspect they may have less than that, but anyway, there is a number, and that's a fairly substantial number. And I agree, you know, this is a very debatable as to how quickly things will go and if it will really come through. The best part of all this to me is that the missile tests have stopped. Mm-hmm. There has not been a test now, knock on wood, since mid-November of 2017. Why this is important is, as General Paul Selva, who's an Air Force general and our vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has pointed out, that, you know, Kim Jong-un never fully tested the long-range missiles. They did not do the realistic warhead reentry, where it skips along the atmosphere. They did not do the downrange testing. He would have needed about a dozen more tests, including going out over the Pacific, to really get that capability. So it's very good that he's been stopped where he is, because this means that even if everything breaks down, his long-range missile arsenal is limited to a very, very few operational missiles at all. And we have defenses specifically built to counter that. So if all we get out of this is stopped missile tests, then I think it's a good thing. But I think there's every chance that we'll see more here. The international sanctions pressure has been really strong. China and Russia have helped. South Korea has done a great job here. And I think we have to let the diplomacy work and see if Kim will live up to his promises or not.
Yes, all the time. Can I go back just real quickly? Our guest in the studio, Dan, had a question for you. Dan is a Marine. They're always Marines, and they're never done with being a Marine. But anyway, Dan, you had a question about it because you're on the ground.
Yes, Dr. Grant, thank you. So from the ground perspective, a lot of pilots I talk to, Air Force folks I talk to, they view air power as something procedural, something calculated. And on the ground, it's far more emotional. If there were blackout air coverage portions of a patrol or something like that, that's what keeps you up at night, not necessarily, you know, things we can control. So my question is, you know, from the guy on the ground's perspective, I think we're in a fascinating time for air power, everything from high-low. I mean, we are in the age of Switchblade, Super Tucano, stuff like that. What does, you know, let's say 5-10 years in the future, from your perspective, look like from the eyes of the guys on the ground? What can we expect?
Well, I think the first thing is that the lessons of Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria are that we have to always have extremely precise air power on call for our forces on the ground. You know, Eisenhower wanted this in World War II. He called it that invaluable weapon for the ground force. But what we see now is that, you know, really nothing moves in the areas in Syria where they're doing the mop-up along the Euphrates, in Iraq when we were still fighting there, and in Afghanistan today, nothing moves without air power on call to provide the surveillance, which is just better all the time, and then also to provide the strikes. And so there are specially trained, you know, as you know, specially trained air controllers that either move with the ground forces or are in constant radio and other communication. So that you can basically call, you know, if you get in trouble, there's an F-18 or an F-15 or something close by. And that has enabled the ground forces to really change the way that they do their fire support. So that is the one, you know, sacred obligation of the Air Force to continue to provide that to the ground forces.
Okay. No, I one other question. Thanks, Dan. I wanted Dan to get his question in there. The other thing is that, you know, we were talking about Korea. Can we go halfway around the world to what's going on in Iran with their nuclear power or whatever it is that they're trying to do?
To Iran, yes, because that's the next question. And, you know, Iran is really at a... I tell you, the Iranians are the worst diplomats. They have a lot of economic problems. As you know, President Trump... moved the U.S. out of the so-called Iran nuclear deal. Europe remains in. And yet what we see the Iranians doing is sending out small boats to harass naval forces. We see them continuing to supply weapons around the region. And most of all, they are really all over Syria, which is something they've done with Russian help. So Iran's presence in the region, also the closing of the U.S. consulate in Basra, Iraq, has happened as partly as a result of Iranian missiles and military pressure in that area. So Iran is trying to become a rising power in that region. They are in a mini Cold War with Saudi Arabia, and we have to settle the question of getting Iran back in the bottle, I think, before we can pull troops out there. The issue with their nuclear development is one that the original deal didn't cover missile development, so they continue to work on that. They work with all the usual bad guys, North Korea, et cetera. And then we want to make sure that they're not enriching uranium to build an arsenal.
All right.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grant. Could you use a little break? What do you say we go to a PSA real quick, okay? We got it all set up? Yes, we'll be right back, Dr. Grant. I'm having a hard day today. Dr. Grant, we'll be right back. There we go, back for the Air Force. And now we're back with Dr. Rebecca Grant. I got that going okay. And we're going to talk about China in shock. I got a whole lot of things. I want an update on military tensions in the South China Sea. You know what they're doing? They're playing. Remember the amusement parks? They had rubber boats, water boats. They were calling them rubber boats or, you know, bumper boats. That's what they called them. And anyway, it sounds like these guys are doing it. The picture I saw, they were all milling around, banging in. Tell us all about that, Dr. Grant.
The latest infraction in the South China Sea is that a Chinese ship came within, we're told, 45 yards of one of our destroyers, the USS Decatur, back earlier this month. And that's way too close. So we've seen China's Navy operating around the South China Seas for a long time. Our Navy does freedom of navigation operations there. And the underlying problem is that China has claimed this area for their own, and they have taken seven little reefs and island features and built up one really big air base, complete with hardened aircraft shelters, petroleum storage, electronic warfare stuff. They don't keep aircraft there regularly, but aircraft do come in. So they have basically militarized this area. And then what happened with Decatur, great job on the part of Decatur's commanding officer, Commander Bowen, and their exec, Lieutenant Commander Molly Lawton, because they did not scrape paint with this Chinese vessel. They were able to turn quickly enough. But it's very hostile, very threatening, and this is a part of some increasing tensions that we've seen all summer. We used to invite China to join a big Pacific exercise that people call RIMPAC. And this year, we did not invite them. It's gotten that bad. So we also see up around Japan a lot, almost daily flights by Chinese aircraft around Japanese airspace. So China is flexing its military muscle. They want to not be contained by U.S. military forces. They want to push back on that area and push U.S. forces further back. But this is international waters. And our Navy's not going anyplace.
What are the Pentagon leaders, they're serious about preparing for China, what are some of the things that they're thinking about doing?
Yeah, very, very serious. And I think we see a shift this year overall. One, of course, is the trade and tariff pushback. Vice President Mike Pence gave a pretty significant speech a couple weeks ago about China's bad behavior in many areas, and from building a surveillance state to intellectual property theft through cyber activity, on into the trade and some things that they've done with other countries. So, you know, I think there's a pretty broad consensus across both parties in Washington that letting China into the free trade club, the World Trade Organization, didn't turn out as well as we expected. The hope was 20 years ago that they would become an equal trading partner and adopt a lot of the Western norms. We haven't seen that at all. What we've seen instead is a huge buildup of military capability and China participated with Russia in their big Eastern exercise back in September. Now, China needs the practice because they have a lot of developing technology, but no combat experience. It's been a very long time since they fought even their border war with Vietnam back in the late 1970s. So, you know, we see China, however, really building up its military forces and exercising them more and trying to be the military great power in the Pacific.
Dr. Grant, I have a quick question, Dale, just two things. With the current administration pulling out of the Pacific Trade Agreement, and now we hear rumors of that they want to withdraw from the nuclear treaty plan with Russia, could we just get your response to those?
Right. Let me start on the Russian treaty. This is a treaty that Reagan and Gorbachev signed in 1987, the INF treaty or the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. It was a big achievement for them. We thought for at least 5 years that Russia has been violating the treaty by testing some new missiles. This was, you know, reported as early as 2014 by the New York Times. But what I see going on here is pretty interesting, because when Putin was in Helsinki, he mentioned possibly wanting to do some additional arms control agreements. And we've seen other Russian military officers talk about this as well. So one possibility, the threat to pull out of the INF treaty is to start a negotiating position to see what additional things can be done. And our national security advisor, John Bolton, is on his trip to Moscow now, trying to do some Helsinki follow-up. I'm sure they're talking about Syria also. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, Russia has been extremely aggressive, and, you know, all of NATO knows that they are in violation of the INF treaty. So the administration has called them on it.
Okay.
Well, one of the things, too, I want to cover is that we're pushing for closer ties with Vietnam. Can you imagine that, boy? I know. Amid those are tensions with China, and do you want to comment on that? How we're trying to counter China's military assertiveness, cozying up to these smaller nations. Tell us about that.
Right, and of course, as you know so well, you know, China and the Soviet Union so prolonged our involvement in Vietnam. Right, I mean, it was. That was a huge part of how why it took so long to bring that conflict to an end and to get our prisoners back. Gosh, that long story I don't have to tell you. But Vietnam is now a very different place with a more vibrant economy, and they don't like the Chinese. And, you know, they are. So it is part of our strategy in the Pacific to have partnerships, and that's our strategy all over the world. Taiwan, Australia, Japan, and now Vietnam is a potential partner in that way, both for trade and defense deals, and also a potentially a very strong strategic partner.
You mentioned the idea. Well, Vietnam and China have been at each other for thousands of years, and China has invaded Vietnam numerous times over the centuries, and Vietnam just wants to be left alone and to grow their own, you know, grow their own country. I was curious as where you see. What about the Space Force that was talked about?
The Space Force. This is potentially the biggest news of the year for the Air Force, because President Trump has asked for the Pentagon to develop a plan to take the Space Force out of the U.S. Air Force. First thing to note, not a big force. We're talking between 6,000 and 13,000 people, if you include uniformed Air Force space operators, as well as civilians. Now, the piece that remains, of course, is what we call national security space, all those CIA spy satellites that someone has to fly. So the overall thrust is to improve our space capabilities, because China, who has almost no commercial launch customers, does a lot of launch activity. They've built up their space launch facilities around Hainan Island. We see a lot of challenges in space, and there's a threat of conflict between satellites, bumping them out of orbit, disrupting satellite communications and observation. So point one is to strengthen the U.S. ability to defend and to operate in space. The question is whether it's better to do that with a specific space force or to keep it integrated with the Air Force where it is today. All the Air Force leaders, and in fact, Secretary Mattis, originally really wanted to keep it in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump's direction to General Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, to, hey, go set up a Space Force was pretty strong. Now, there will be some additional costs, and in the end, Capitol Hill will get to decide whether they'll authorize and approve the money for an independent Space Force. That will be the key.
That's always the magic question. Where is the money going to come from this time?
Well, we're talking a lot about the future. We have 5 minutes left, and boy, I don't know where to go with this thing on space. Do we stay in our atmosphere? Do we go into space? Dr. Grant, I was looking here at some, I saw one design on television. I believe it was called the Flex System, wing design. It was all the way from the nose to what would be, there is no wing. It's a, spaceship, right? Dale's looking at it. Help me with this, Dr. Grant. What's in the future right now with the Air Force as far as space and aircraft, et cetera, and where are we at on the development?
Yeah, the space futurology. The question is, will our next combat planes really be space transiting planes? It's like the high-low mix that Dan was asking about earlier. We've seen mysterious platforms like Boeing's X-37, which managed to stay up on orbit for a very long time. We know that the technical ability is there to make a space transiting bomber or a space transiting aircraft. Right now, we use space primarily for surveillance and for communication, obviously. But does space now become a combat realm like we saw happen with the air in World War I? Is space now the new easel, Bob, as you put it? So the technology is there to do it. It's a question of the technology trade-offs and then also of whether we regard space as a warfighting domain. Our space commanders like to say that, you know, there is no such thing as war in space, there's just war. And if we have to fight and defend our space assets, that's something we'll have to do. But I expect we could see in the next 5 to 10 years, or 20 years even, a very interesting range of technologies, including space transiting craft.
Wow. Dale? last word here, Dale?
No, I'm just always amazed, Dr. Grant, when we get an opportunity to talk to you. It's always nice to hear an official source of information, because the information that we get many times is from various people and, you know, whatever their agendas are. And we want to thank you so much for your objective views on everything and how much it helps us understand what's actually going on.
I love talking with you all. You ask the best questions, and you're always on top of the topics. You saw North Korea coming long before a lot of people did. I just love talking with Veterans Radio.
Dan, do you have a last comment?
No comments here. Just thank you very much. Wish we can get more time from you. Absolutely fascinating. Hours just blown by.
Well, Dr. Grant, by the way, we're going to have our 15th
anniversary is coming up.
Would you please give us a call for a very quick hello and thank you and whatever, you know, that holds? We'll let you know. Would you be able to give us a quick call?
Absolutely. 15th, congratulations. That's fantastic. Yes, of course.
And the second and third thing that we want to start the year as we have for the last 6 years with you being our premier guest on our first program in 2019. And I want to say right now, from Gene, Dan, Dale, myself, you have yourself a great day, and thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. How much time have we got?
Two, three. Good.
There's a couple of things I want to make sure that our audience knows that we are. Veterans Radio is sponsored by American House Vinoy in Westland, Michigan, and also that we are sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans. I think it's really important. If you have some questions about your benefits and so forth, next week is our benefits program. So we hope that you will give us a call or send us an email beforehand, and we will take care of that. Another plug I want to give is for the Fisher House fundraiser is on November 5th at Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and this is going to be a Stories of Service. It's about a number of veterans are going to be telling their stories from World War II up until today's world. And I get the privilege of being one of the co-hosts, so I'm really excited about that. Myself and Kate Melcher. Kate is an Apache helicopter pilot, and so we're going to trade war stories and exaggerations throughout the evening. So I want to make sure of that. And then I know we wanted to get Dan to talk a little bit real quickly about. Do you have something you wanted to say?
No, when you're through, I will.
Okay. All right. Well, I wanted to get Dan to talk about Griffin Secure Transport for one, you know, like 30 seconds.
Thank you. So one point of clarification. It's G-R-I-F-F-I-N. So GriffinSecureTransport.com if you want more information. And one point, just thinking of it, I come from the world where everybody is between the ages of, 18 and 30. And so this is to all the listeners out there. We're looking for a level-headed, mature group of veteran employees So to build up our team. So it's not limited to, your enlistment age of 18. If you're interested, reach out and contact us. Just like the Spartan Phalanx, they wanted the middle-aged folks on their first line because those are the folks with level-headed team players. So please, Griffin Secure Transport.
Okay, that's it. Bob Gould for our crew. Until next week, you are dismissed. We'll be right back.